Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Just under 15 hours from now, the greater Sacramento region will be under a minimum three-week-long stay-at-home order. This adds roughly 3 million people to the list of Californians already under such orders, 27 million residents in the San Joaquin Valley and Southern California regions fell under the stay-at-home orders last weekend. Our area, as designated by California public health officials and Governor Gavin Newsom, includes Alpine, Amador, Butte, Colusa, El Dorado, Nevada, Placer, Plumas, Sacramento, Sierra, Sutter, Yolo, and Yuba counties. Intensive care unit beds dipped just below 15% availability rate on Tuesday. That triggered the action. Cap Radio's state government reporter Scott Rodd is here with the latest on the stay-at-home order. And Scott, as always, thanks for joining us. Let's begin with the latest developments. What happens tonight at midnight?
So a number of businesses will be closing. Basically at the stroke of midnight. So barbershops, movie theaters, nail salons, also things like museums, these businesses are going to be closed. The idea essentially is to get people to stay at home as much as possible and to have them avoid indoor activities where they may come in contact with other people. Now, this isn't a complete shutdown of the economy or anything like that. There are still things that will be open. So restaurants will be open for takeout and delivery. However, indoor dining will not be open. In-person dining won't be available, whether indoor or outdoor. Retail can remain open, but they can only allow 20% capacity for customers. So as you can imagine, that may be a little bit tricky coming down sort of the holiday home stretch. Schools that have been open can remain open. Ones that weren't open previously, they have to continue during, when I say open, I mean for in-person learning. And ones that were doing distance learning have to continue doing that. Travel is still encouraged. It's still encouraged that people don't travel if it's not essential. Hotels won't be taking reservations in the regions that have the stay-at-home order. However, there are certain things that people certainly can still do. Doctor's visits, dentist visits, they can continue to do that. And then things like grocery stores and gas stations, those will also be open, you know, for obviously essential needs that people have.
In the lead up, I mentioned a minimum of 3 weeks. Could it be reevaluated if by chance we see some improvement?
Unfortunately, no. It's going to be 3 weeks at least. Partly that's because hospitalizations and ICU numbers lag behind case numbers. So we've seen a spike in cases. We're already seeing the capacity for ICU drop. But unfortunately, we're going to probably continue to see that drop happen as a result of the case spike that we've seen in recent days and weeks. So that three-week minimum is meant to give hospitals a chance to get more capacity, try to bring that case numbers down. So unfortunately, it'll be in place for a little bit.
Yeah, the state of California hit a record number of deaths yesterday. We've done some reporting on the use of the Sleep Train Arena as a field hospital. What do we know there?
Yeah, so as some people may remember hearing, the state and the Sacramento Kings entered into an agreement that allowed the Sleep Train Arena, which is the former arena for the Kings north of downtown, to be used as an overflow field hospital. It was activated for a little while, then it went dormant. It now has been reactivated. However, only the practice facility right now is being used, is open and receiving patients. So that has 66 beds in it. The arena itself has capacity for much more than that, over 100 beds. However, I spoke to Cal OES yesterday, and they said that there isn't a timeline to open up that arena yet. And there are a couple factors. One, if there is surging demand for more beds, then they will certainly do what they can to open it. But really, the big challenge is staffing. And that's its challenge for hospitals across the state, across the country. Getting the necessary staff to run these beds, to provide the support. When people say ICU capacity, they don't mean really the beds. It's not like there's a shortage of hospital gurneys happening. It's more so the staff that's able to provide the support and care.
Yeah. Scott, there was a significant change to the stay-at-home order yesterday that was done quietly, but since updated on the state's COVID response webpage. Can you tell us more about the change regarding playgrounds?
Yeah, that's right. A significant change, certainly for some, maybe not for bachelors like myself, but if you're a parent with a kid, it's definitely a big change. So the state, at the start of the stay-at-home order, said that playgrounds would be shut down, even ones outside. And parents said, you know, this is one of the only things that my kid can do, and it's a great opportunity for them to get outside and have exercise. And a number of lawmakers said the same thing. So they started lobbying the governor's office to reopen playgrounds. And as you mentioned, the governor's office did somewhat quietly. They just made a change to the guidelines online. And now playgrounds are open. So, you know, it's still encouraged that there is social distancing, that, you know, all the sort of standard safety protocols are still adhered to. But playgrounds right now are open. So I'm sure many parents are rejoicing.
I guess there's a lot of natural ultraviolet light that's, you know, bathing those playgrounds and killing the coronavirus in the process. So,
and I think also just generally, you know, this is an outdoor activity, and the state is encouraging people to, you know, get outside, to exercise. Of course, again, do it safely, follow all the protocols. But, you know, again, the state is telling people to stay at home as much as possible, but to still exercise, because that's so important for obviously physical well-being, but also mental well-being. And for kids, playing at a playground, that's one of the best ways to do it.
All right, Scott, let's talk about enforcement. Who will be charged with enforcing the stay-at-home order? And we've heard some talk about some law enforcement agencies that have refused to do so.
That's right. So the state is really relying on county and local governments to handle enforcement. And what that looks like is, you know, for the most part, there's a kind of education first attitude, you know, try to educate people about what the rules are. And then if necessary, you know, take a punitive approach. But again, that's, you know, not the ideal scenario. However, a number of counties, including our own Sacramento County, the sheriff's departments have come out and said, look, we're not going to enforce this. We're not going to, you know, we will take an education first approach, but we're not going to enforce things like, for example, mask mandates, you know, breaking up social gatherings, things of that nature. And, you know, the consequence of that is somewhat unclear. Governor Gavin Newsom has said if counties refuse to enforce these orders, you know, there may be a reallocation of some of the federal funding that the state has received for, you know, local and county relief. Of course, that raises the question of, you know, is that perhaps hurting the wrong, you know, is that punitive for the wrong folks? You know, is that really, could it be hurting people who really need that money who just happen to live in a county where they're not enforcing it? So we'll see what happens there.
Scott, if I could put you on hold for just a moment, let's welcome in Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn to our conversation. And Chief Hahn, welcome back to Insight. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So what role does the Sacramento Police Department have in enforcing the stay-at-home order?
Well, I mean, you know, from time to time we get calls on it, so we will respond and take an education mode. But enforcement doesn't necessarily have to come in like the criminal justice system. So in regards to business, our code enforcement in the city, which isn't in under the police department, deals with all the businesses. And so that could be anywhere from fines to business license to things like that if it's egregious and they don't comply after education, but that would be the code enforcement division doing that.
Has it been difficult over the past 9 or 10 months since the virus showed up in terms of keeping the public safe?
Well, yeah, there's been a lot of things that are difficult that come with COVID that we're all facing, but also with police officers, you know, they, as an officer, you can't work from home and you're not always able to distance yourself from somebody. If you're arresting somebody, it's pretty hard to distance yourself, and working these protests is very difficult to distance yourself. So there's a few extra challenges that come with being law enforcement in our city.
Yeah, for the past several weeks, you mentioned the protests. There have been these post-election protests at the state capitol that have extended into the streets of Sacramento, where it becomes your jurisdiction. Our reporter, Scott Rodd, who's also on the call here, did some reporting. Let's listen to this.
Hey!
I'm not sure that that was the exact sound that we were looking for, but we had.
I'm not sure I know what that was.
Right. Well, there's some pro-Trump and anti-Trump, lots of different groups there at the Capitol, and there has been some violence and vandalism. Here is some perspective from one woman who Scott interviewed last weekend.
There was a slashed tire. Was there a broken window as well, or just slashed tires?
No, just slashed tires. Just tires. There's that one, and I think this one, I don't know what they did to this.
Were you expecting anything like this?
No, not at all. I saw all the police force everywhere. I thought we would be just fine. Mm-hmm. No.
Do you think you'll come down to a protest again?
Yeah, we probably would. We just wouldn't park with anything on it.
So, Chief Hahn, what's your plea to the public about these protests, especially given that we're going into a stay-at-home order starting at midnight?
Yeah, it's the same I've always had. So I think we have both. And that reporting from last week, I think, exhibits it. We have protesting at the Capitol. Those are folks that want to come down, speak their opinion. I think this last week was about the election. And so that's what I would call protesting. And then the other stuff that we saw is not protesting. It's just they come down to assault each other. That's not protected. That's not First Amendment. And if you look at the groups online anyway, or social media wise, that are purporting to be the groups that were down there, they intended to do that before the protest started, and then they bragged about it afterwards. So I wouldn't call that protest. I think that's putting a bad light on the actual protesters. Whether you agree with protesters' sentiment or not, as long as they're protesting, legitimately protesting, then they have every right to do that, and we want to support that. But what we saw last week was both some protesters and some non-protesters.
Your department has spent a significant amount of resources policing demonstrations in 2020. Can you discuss how the department's approach may have changed, or what lessons have been learned, or how you can offer a window into how the department is preparing for policing demonstrations going forward?
Yeah, I think we've learned a lot over time, and a lot of that is just learning better ways to keep groups separated, especially this latest round of the last month down at the Capitol. And unfortunately, it comes at a time where our neighborhoods are experiencing increased violence. So we're bringing like 150 officers every Saturday to keep groups apart from beating on each other and assaulting each other. And so it takes away from our neighborhoods. And at the same time, now we have officers that are in the middle of groups, many of which aren't wearing masks. And so now not only is it challenging time while you're being assaulted by these so-called protesters, but you're also at a higher risk of getting COVID and taking it home to your family. So yeah, there's a lot of reasons why I wish people would just exercise their rights instead of being violent and conducting this activity downtown.
And it's the protesters that are not wearing the masks, not the officers. I just want to clarify, right?
Yes, correct.
Yes. Okay. I want to bring Scott Rodd back into the conversation. Scott, you wanted to address something?
Yeah. Hi, Chief Hahn. Thanks so much for joining us. As Randall mentioned, I've been out most of the last 5 weekends covering the protests. And, I've spoken to a number of kind of everyday average Sacramentans who either, live or travel through downtown. And they've asked me, why has this continued, these protests continue to happen that have turned violent pretty much every single weekend that's been down there? It's not just property damage. I mean, people are, getting beat up and people are getting into fist fights. And, they've asked, these permits, as far as I understand, are not permitted. These protests are not permitted. And so people have just been asking, it seems like the police are facilitating these protests with kind of the barricades around them by the Capitol. So I guess one, what's your response to that? What are police doing to try to facilitate people's First Amendment rights, but not have that violence continue? And will there be anything different about how the police handles these protests in the coming weeks? Because it doesn't seem like it'll be stopping anytime soon.
Yeah, I would challenge anybody that says we facilitate violence. I can't think of any actions that we've done that has facilitated violence. But do we block streets? Absolutely. We don't want cars mixing with protesters. But a lot of the groups that I think people are talking about are not protesters. They came down there to commit violence. So if we can make arrests, we will. We have made arrests in the past, and we've made arrests after the protests were over. But like, for example, this last weekend, the people we talked to that had been assaulted, they didn't want anything done. Matter of fact, some of them wouldn't even tell us their own names. So it's hard to make an arrest when the victim doesn't want anything done. And then a lot of the property damage on the cars was while groups were walking back to their, I guess you could call it their home base, while our officers were largely tied up and trying to continue to keep groups apart. And I think the telltale sign is when you see the protests that have gone over the last several months where they're walking through our streets and what I would call real protesters, they're not wearing helmets. They're not carrying backpacks full of rocks. They don't have frozen water bottles and canned food that they're throwing at people. But in these last couple of weeks, like last weekend, they came dressed like that and they brought a change of clothes and hid themselves behind umbrellas and changed their clothes after they damaged all the cars to try to prevent from being identified. Now, that in and of itself isn't illegal, but it kind of gives you an insight that there was a pre-planning in regards to what they planned on doing.
Mm-hmm. And just to jump in real quick, I'm glad you clarified. I meant facilitating the protests, not facilitating violence, but people were saying facilitating the protests that were, you know, sort of spilling over in some instances into kind of violence on the side. But anyways, I can, yeah, certainly attest to the fact that being there the last 4 to 5 weeks, certainly these are very fluid situations, exactly what you said, you know, trying to contain everything that's happening in this large area downtown. I've seen it. I can only imagine how difficult it is.
Yeah. Chief Hunt, we're going over just a little bit here, but I do want to bring up one more point. And you mentioned that violent crime is up in the city. Assaults are up, homicides are up. And this really goes against decades of a downward trend. So what do you think is behind the resurgence? Is it the economy, increased gun sales, you know, effects of the pandemic? What does your expertise tell you?
Yeah, I mean, I could tell you like 10 different things that I think are contributing factors, and there's probably 20 more in addition to that. But, you know, it's in my mind, it's kind of like a perfect storm. So one, you have a situation right now where nobody's really staying in jail when they get arrested, even for pretty serious crimes. They're being let out with about an hour and a half hour due to the courts and partly due to COVID. People are being let out of prison very high rates. We've seen them coming to Sacramento if they don't have a place to go. So now they're part of our homeless population. There is no, that I can tell, reentry program for these folks. So we're literally just opening the door and not helping them reintegrate back into our community, which, you know, you can look at studies and see that reentry programs work. We have a health order that has pretty much eliminated the vast majority of activities that young people can be involved in, whether it's school or sports or, you know, those sort of activities where they're not only doing something productive and physical, but they're also in contact with mentors and things like that. So things have moved to online. A lot of our groups have done as best they could, moving to online and keeping in touch with kids, but we've seen increased suicides. We've seen increased in mental health. And then you have a lot of the protests going on, and we have gang problem already before all this happened. So all it takes is a little gang war going on, and then you have increased shooting. So there's a lot of factors that play into it, like with anything else. And for sure, one of the challenges is increased people out in our streets and our officers being tied up on other things and not being able to work. We've had people that were released from custody that were victims and suspects in shootings that, you know, a year ago would have still been in custody, so they wouldn't have got shot or wouldn't have been able to shoot somebody. So it's a lot of factors that play into it. Mm-hmm.
Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hunn, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Cap Radio's Scott Rodd, we appreciate your reporting. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
And up next, Stockton already under stay-at-home orders. West Sacramento starts tonight. What are their new mayors doing to help businesses survive and their vision for post-pandemic success? If you have a question for the new mayors, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. You can also use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, back in just a moment.
Hi, Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. While the November 3rd general election may have been overshadowed by the top of the ticket race between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, there were a few rather large political shakeups at the local level. A few cities in our listening area elected new mayors, and some of those outcomes could be categorized as upsets. West Sacramento and Stockton are two of those, both communities unseating two very popular or high-profile mayors, now former West Sacramento Mayor Christopher Cabaldon and Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs. Cabaldon was elected mayor by the people of West Sacramento for 16 years. He also served as mayor prior to that, but under a council form of mayoral selection. Many credit Cabaldon with transforming West Sacramento into a more urban, livable city with a lot of new amenities and businesses, as well as transforming the West Sac waterfront. Tubbs, meanwhile, was mayor of Stockton since 2017. And in January 2013, at the age of 22, he was the youngest council member in Stockton history and one of the youngest elected officials in the United States. Tubbs gained national attention over his tenure. He brought universal basic income to Stockton and was very recently the subject of an HBO documentary called Stockton on My Mind. But on November 3rd, voters in both cities called for change. Today on Insight, we have newly sworn in West Sacramento Mayor Martha Guerrero. Nice to have you with us this morning, Mayor.
Good morning. Thank you, Randall. Thank you for having me. Morning.
You bet. Also, Stockton's new mayor, Kevin Lincoln, who is sworn in on January 13th, and he joins us on Insight as well. Hello, Mayor-elect.
Hey, good morning, Randall. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I do want to mention that we did work to include Elk Grove's new mayor as part of this conversation, but we're unable to secure that interview. So hopefully we could make that happen early in Mayor Bobby Singh Allen's tenure. Let's begin in West Sacramento. Mayor Guerrero, congratulations. You were sworn into office just last night. So tell us about that moment and what it meant for you.
Well, thank you, Randall. It was you know, I'm just honored and humbled by the fact that I am now their mayor. Mayor Cabaldon has, past Mayor Cabaldon has done an incredible job in our city, and you've seen the growth. And moving forward, they've acknowledged that there's a need for change, and I'm really honored that I'm a part of that.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about your background, specifically your work for Los Angeles County, and then also your training as a social worker.
That's correct. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I do represent Los Angeles County as their legislator for this Board of Supervisors in the legislature.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you could foresee in representing LA County in that way that could come in conflict with a much smaller municipality like West Sacramento?
Absolutely not. Los Angeles County is extremely large. And the difference is that, you know, Yolo County has, you know, different needs compared to Los Angeles County. And I do represent them on specific issues, social services, which only Yolo County delivers those services. So I'm not a board of supervisor. I'm a city council member. So it's specific to county service operations.
Right. And so you mentioned a city council member. Give us a little of your background and how it prepares you to implement your plans for the city.
I've been on the local mental health board since I moved in pretty much in 2004. And with that background, that helped me to understand the gaps in services here in West Sacramento. And I work to close those gaps by providing services in mental health and homelessness, and also looking at the economic plan for our future, which I think is much needed today. Looking at COVID and the impact it has had in our ability to provide restaurants the support they need, and other businesses that are having to close down. And so that experience and economic recovery is going to come in very handy.
So Mayor Cabaldon has had a lot of success over the years. In fact, the last time he was actually challenged for the mayor's seat was back in 2008. What was it about the direction he was leading the city that made you decide you wanted to challenge Mayor Cabaldon?
The impact that I've noticed most significant is direct relationship with the community. And I have been out working with the individuals and meeting with them as a council member. And they appreciate a responsiveness from a council member. And as mayor, I plan on continuing to do that. And I noticed that that is what they are looking for in being heard and having a responsive local government to their interest.
Mm-hmm. One of the bigger issues people weigh in on when they decide whether or not to live in West Sacramento is the school system. A quick search reveals that the Washington Unified School District ranks average or below average in several key categories, including graduation rates, also English and math proficiency. What, as mayor, are you going to do or can you do to improve schools in the city?
And that was exactly on my platform, is to increase access to after-school programs to provide enrichment, including tutoring and activities so that youth have outlets, improve their self-confidence, and utilize resources that we have in our Home Run program so that we can bridge those that are in the lower socioeconomic and struggling academically, so that they have the resources to bridge with the school district so that they excel in the long run.
So let's talk about the next 24 hours. At midnight, we go under stay-at-home orders because West Sac, of course, is in Yolo County, which is part of this new lockdown. What is the plan moving forward for that? How will you help the city of West Sacramento during these hopefully final months of the COVID-19 pandemic?
It's been challenging for West Sacramento and the pandemic and the impact it's had on the businesses. And I have been reaching out to the businesses directly, looking at how we can improve maintaining them open in a way that is safe and encouraging the residents to do all they can to prevent the spread, having personal responsibility, wearing their mask, because that's what it'll take in order for us to reduce the numbers and the spread. And so that and helping them to boost their takeout, providing them with the resources so that it can safely be done. And I personally have gone to the restaurants and businesses so that I can help them improve access to whatever it is that they can provide for resources to our city and maintain their operation.
What does West Sacramento look like 4 years from now under a Guerrero leadership?
I believe we'll have a thriving economic future. We'll have residents who will see that they have outdoor activities that they've been seeking, additional bike paths and walking paths, that we'll have more businesses here in West Sacramento. And we will improve public transportation because that is a need that we have here, and also infrastructure, that we have the appropriate resources in place to serve the residents.
All right. West Sacramento Mayor Martha Guerrero, if you can hang on for just a couple of minutes, I do want to bring in Kevin Lincoln, the mayor-elect of Stockton, and congratulations on your victory as well.
Thank you, Randall.
So let's begin with your background first and ultimately why you decided to run for mayor of Stockton.
Sure. Well, my background, I grew up here in Stockton, and I joined the Marine Corps when I was 20 years old. When I got out, I got connected with a private security company in the Bay Area, ultimately becoming their district manager, running their Silicon Valley operation. So I was responsible for an annual budget, a little over $55 million, had two district offices and 21 district employees with over 1,300 employees on the field. So from a corporate standpoint, very familiar with navigating through very comprehensive RFP processes, understanding what it takes, you know, to maintain a high level of client satisfaction, but most importantly, you know, serving your employees. Because if your employees are your number one net promoter, then you're going to have great customer relationships as well. I decided to make the transition after 8 years of doing that to work here in town on the ground for a local nonprofit as their executive administrator, which is a local church. So very, very familiar, became very familiar with the needs in our city, the issues that have been plaguing our city and the impact that it's had on our families. And, you know, just after reading a book one night last October, it was just, these thoughts just came over me, 30,000 feet thoughts of what it would look like, you know, to see change in our city. And I thought, man, maybe I should run for mayor one day. So my initial thought to run for mayor was actually in 2024. But then, you know, over the course of the following month, I had several conversations and the decision was made to run for mayor now. And I'm thankful that I did.
You mentioned changes for the city. Can you pinpoint for our listeners what the issues or issue was that was not working, in your opinion, under a Tubbs administration?
Sure. Well, the people of Stockton, they did vote for change. And what they want is a leader that's going to focus on the fundamental needs of the city, not necessarily personal agenda or my personal priorities. And to Mayor Guerrero's point, one of the greatest opportunities that were missed and have been missed is the increased level of civic engagement, you know, being visible, being accessible. The people of Stockton for years, even beyond just this past 4 years, have felt, you know, marginalized. They felt disenfranchised. There's been a huge amount of distrust. And that was one of the main priorities, you know, and actually a policy point throughout this campaign, is to increase the level of civic engagement and be accessible to the public and build bridges of trust throughout our community by focusing on the fundamental needs of our city.
Will you continue with Mayor Tubbs' universal basic income plan?
So those are all programs that were not a part of the city. Those were programs that were in line with his nonprofit and the priorities that he set.
Mm-hmm. Would you try to start something like that? Do you think it's a good idea?
Well, you know, I'm open to change. I'm open to creative ideas that will move our entire city forward. I'm not familiar with all the data and all the facts. I don't have access to that information. But I want to focus on programs that work and benefit the entire city.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those. What would you list as your top priorities?
So, you know, the top priorities that not only impact Stockton and our county, but other cities and counties throughout California, and quite frankly, the nation, it's growing throughout the nation, is this issue in and around the homeless crisis that we all find ourselves in. I think if there's one particular issue that really unites us across the board, across different municipalities, that's the issue there. So when we, the community of Stockton, over 80% saw that as number one issue going into the campaign. And, you know, now with having to navigate the pandemic and everything that comes along with that, our economy and crime are the next two issues there.
So what would you do differently regarding homeless people who are homeless in the city of Stockton, and how would you measure success of years down the road?
Sure. So, you know, we can have a more of a comprehensive conversation about this, because there's not a silver bullet to address homelessness. It's so complex, and you have to take a multifaceted approach. And there's many different solutions, you know, that you think of it as a puzzle. And there's many different pieces, you know, that are going to make up that puzzle. And that's what we have to focus on. We have to focus on every area across the board that's going to be a part of solution, and then move the needle. One of the things that we've identified in our community, in addition to more transitional housing and more affordable long-term housing, which are all very important and are necessary, and we have to continue to focus in those areas. But one of the opportunities that we've identified to help improve the quality of life for all Stocktonians moving forward in and around homelessness is this opportunity to increase our emergency shelter capacity and expand bed capacity while implementing navigation services there so that those who are homeless can come through and they can essentially get triage, and we can help identify the direction to take them. One of the challenges is having that type of emergency shelter that is able to accommodate partners, possessions, and pets. You know, those are a few of the barriers that prevent somebody right now who is unsheltered from taking that next step towards healing. And so it's very important to understand that as we address homelessness, it's important to understand that every single unsheltered person and homeless person, they have a story, and every story is important, and we need to do everything we can to meet them at the point of their need while improving the quality of life for them and everybody else in our city.
Yeah. Mayor-elect, we're seeing a lot of people move out of the Bay Area into the Sacramento region. You know, they can keep their Bay Area salaries, but work from home here in a much less expensive home. I know Stockton has been somewhat of a bedroom community for Silicon Valley for years. You even have the ACE commuter train. Are you seeing even more migration now? And how do you think that helps or hurts the Stockton community?
I think it helps the Stockton community because it's going to bring in, additional revenue into our city. And so, you know, as a community, we have to make ourselves more attractive as well, right? And mm-hmm. so we need to focus on, continue to focus on the branding of our community, the culture of our city, so that more and more people will want to make Stockton home. Stockton is very unique. We like to refer to ourselves as the biggest, smallest city, where we may be 320,000 in our population, with a third of our population being under the age of 18. But, you know, we like to say we have a hometown feel and vibe to it. There's a lot of people in our city who have deep roots, generational roots, and have pride in our community and really genuinely love our city and want to see our city succeed.
Yeah, I think Reno might already have a lock on that expression, but
yeah.
but I'm sure there's one you can find, you know,
sure.
Just massage it just a little bit. Mayor Guerrero and Mayor-elect Lincoln, and I'll start with you, Mayor Guerrero, just briefly, where do you see or what can you learn from your constituents that can really help you in your job?
My constituents are excited by the opportunity that my skills as a social worker can coalesce them to be a part of what we can do to support our community. And I think that is an opportunity that we look forward to working together. And so it'll be enhancing public participation, volunteer activities. I'm noticing that when I'm serving at the Yolo Food Bank, that we have increased participation from volunteers. I think mm-hmm. that getting people involved who have a lot of pride and just love to give back to the community, bringing people together.
And Mayor-elect Lincoln, same to you, but in about 30 seconds, if you can.
Sure. Listen, continue what we've been doing on the campaign, and that is listening to the public so that we can learn the specific needs throughout our community, and then we can effectively lead together. Change is not going to come on the burden of one individual's shoulders alone. It's going to take entire community. What do they say? It takes a village.
Right. Yeah. Mayor-elect Kevin Lincoln of Stockton, thank you so much.
Thank you, Randall. I appreciate this.
Thank you.
Also, Mayor Martha Guerrero.
Mayor Guerrero.
Yeah, Mayor Martha Guerrero, sworn in last night, West Sacramento. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
Still ahead, Cap Radio takes a tip from a 75-year-old Icelandic holiday tradition. We'll dive into that with Donna Apadoni. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. We're back in just a moment. We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. In Iceland, the month of December is a time of celebration, like many other places. But this is not just any celebration. We're talking about a celebration of books. Jóla Bókaflóð, which translates to, thank you, Donna, which translates to Yule Book Flood, is a tradition that dates back to wartime and rationing. And because there was no shortage of paper to go around, people would give books as gifts during the holiday season. Well, this week, the CAP Radio Reads podcast took the 75-year-old tradition and extended it to all the holidays of this winter solstice month. Donna Abedoni is the host of Morning Edition and CAP Radio Reads, and she joins us now. Great to have you here, Donna.
Nice to be with you, Randall. I'm wearing my Nordic sweater and I brought my sleigh bells because it's an Icelandic conversation.
Right. And because we're over Zoom, neither of us have masks on, but normally when I see you, we're in the hallway at CAP Radio and we're all masked up.
Oh, yeah.
So tell us about this tradition and its origins. We went over it a little bit there. More importantly, the name.
Jóla Bókaflóð. I'm told it translates as Yule Book Flood. Just a flood of books at Christmas time. What a great idea. And I was also told, I read about this a couple of years ago. I also heard that it goes back 75 years to World War II. As you mentioned, there was a shortage, a lot of shortages. And because it was December in Iceland, people were staying at home. And I thought, that sounds familiar. You can't get paper products at the store and you have to stay at home a lot. Sounds like the COVID situation. So what a great time to bring back an old tradition and spread it out, because I'm kind of an equal opportunity December holiday celebrator. So I'm extending this to Hanukkah, to Christmas, to New Year's, and I'm thinking about all of the books that we can possibly bring in. So here's what we did. Usually the podcast for CAP Radio Reads is me interviewing one author, totally different this time around. I worked with Vicki Lorini. We got together four authors we know and then brought in eight people who work at CAP Radio and said, listen, if you were going to stay up all night with this Jóla Bókaflóð tradition, if you were going to stay up all night reading a book, what book would you want to read? What book would you recommend to other people? But before we could get to that, we had to learn how to say the name of the holiday.
Right. that's the big trick, right?
It is.
In fact, I'm going to tell the control room here. I want to flip the sound bites that we have because Donna just led so perfectly into that. We have some CAP Radio staff who were trying to pronounce this. And so let's listen to that.
The Jóla Bókaflóð.
Jóla Bókaflóð. Jóla Bókaflóð.
Jóla Bókaflóð. Jóla Bókaflóð. Jóla Bókaflóð.
See, it's not easy.
That last one was Nicole Nixon. I definitely recognize Devin Yamanaka in there. And starting
and
it off,
Devin Cortan. And an author who I interviewed recently named Alka Joshi.
So you also spoke with Bara Floyd, which sounds like almost like the last two syllables of the last portion of that word. Bara Floyd, a president of the Icelandic American Association of Southern California. What did she have to say about all this?
Well, having grown up in Iceland, she could relate to it. She's a younger person than 75 years, so she doesn't go back to the beginnings of the tradition. But she explained that even when she was a kid, there wasn't a lot of TV in Iceland. So what did you do in the winter? You read books. So it made a lot of sense to do it that way. She also explained some of the other intricacies of what kinds of books, a lot of biographies. It became sort of a cultural thing in Iceland to read about Icelandic people, not just novels that you'd pick up anywhere. So, and she taught me how to say the name of the holiday. So that was very helpful.
And we have a little piece here from Bara. Let's go ahead and hear that.
I would say part of the reason why books are so popular too is we didn't have television. That's what you did, read books instead of just watching TV. Part of the books that come out too are like biographies of some known people in our society, not just novels, but biographies too.
Yeah, there she follows up on the biography. Yeah, the biography thing.
Great.
So the type of book does matter.
Right, it definitely matters. And I love that idea of just snuggling up and hunkering down. And so we had a great time putting this together and heard, as I said, from four authors. Let me tell you who they are. Georgianne Brennan, who we know because she lives down the road, Cara Black, Meg Waite Clayton, and Alka Joshi, who wrote The Henna Artist. And then we had eight people coming in to the studio who work at Cap Radio, including our general manager, Jun Reina, who said, here's the book that he would suggest that people read. So it's just really a fun December celebration. It can include all of the December holidays because books are universal. Cold weather is pretty universal. And why not just, we have to stay at home anyway. Why not enjoy some good books, stay up all night and read with a cup of hot cocoa or an adult beverage?
Yeah, that's right. And a happy Hanukkah to those who celebrate. I believe, does that start today?
Starts tonight, yeah.
Yeah, starts tonight. Uh-huh, at
exactly.
sundown.
Exactly.
Yeah. So Donna, if this is something that just is ringing a bell with somebody listening, what advice do you have for that person who wants to start doing this with friends or with family?
Well, just spread the word. It's so easy to say, hey, I'm going to do this. I'm going to stay up all night on a Saturday or New Year's Eve or part of Hanukkah or Christmas Eve. And here's what I'm going to do. We can't get together this holiday season, but I'll read the book and tell you what I like. And you can read a book and tell you what you like. And then it can be a Zoom or a phone exchange. And it's just a nice way of celebrating some holidays together since we're staying at home.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
Let's get into, we have just a couple of minutes left here, so let's get into your book recommendations for this holiday season.
Yeah, I'd love to
and
tell you.
What you've been reading, because you are a voracious reader.
I have to be with this job, yeah. I have three books that I'd like to suggest that people might want to read over the holiday season. One is a legal thriller, and John Lesquois, I've read most of his books. I love them all. My favorite is The Ophelia Cut, for reasons I can't tell you. You have to read the book, but it's just, I love it. And then there are two books that came out of the UK, one that I read during holiday seasons. One, or three rather, the Merlin Trilogy by Mary Stewart. She treats these books as if she's writing biographies of Merlin the Magician from childhood on up. And, you know, I think anybody who can write four pages describing the side of a mountain and intrigue me by that is worth reading. So Mary Stewart's Merlin Trilogy. And then another favorite author of mine is Jan Morris. She just died a couple of weeks ago and spent a lot of her time writing books that reflected her travels. She lived in Wales, and her book called A Writer's House in Wales is another one of those. She's describing the walls and the beams, but it's so fascinating to read. You feel like you're right there with her. So those are a few of the books that I would find that I would recommend as enticing and interesting to read during the holiday season. They're not related to the holidays in any way, but they're just a good snuggle up book.
Donna, you're inspiring me. I was speaking with the Insight crew before the show today, and all of us, you know, kind of said the same thing. We read so many articles and, you know, preparing for the show, and I will skim books if we have an author on in order to get through it. But the last time I sat down with just a book for pleasure was a long time ago, but I have some time off coming up in a little bit. And I think you have inspired me. I'm going to give a book and buy one for myself.
Let me just add one more thing. To hear the people, these 12 people, describe the books that they recommend is fascinating. Book recommendations can be kind of dull, but they get so excited and so passionate and are so willing to share what they like to read that it's just a really entertaining 25-minute podcast to listen to at capradio.org/reads.
I love it. Donna Abbadoni, host of Morning Edition and Cap Radio Reads. Thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Keep reading.
Yola Bocaflord.
Yola Bocaflord.
That's Insight for today. I'm Randall White, producer Cynthia Lopez, Kyle McKinnon, and managing editor R.M. Sarkissian. We'll catch you back here on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.